Okay, so we are going to look at the next part of the Gospel of Mark. Mark chapter 4, verses 35 through chapter 5, verses 20. It's a fairly long section. Two miracle stories. And because I was traveling, I don't have any sort of quotes or footnoting here. It's not that I didn't look at the commentaries in different places, but I just didn't have the way. I didn't have a good way of putting them together, so it's more of a definitely a straight outline of kind of my thoughts. So Mark returns to miracle stories to demonstrate the power of Jesus' teachings. There are four or three such stories next, depending on how you choose to count them.
Okay.
One commentary suggests that the first two, the calming of the storm and the exorcism of the demoniac, are both exorcism stories, and the two together tell a single story. So that commentary counts that as one story, even though they are two separate narratives.
Two obviously different narratives.
But commentaries that treat them as two different stories, they do note and acknowledge their relatedness. They have similarities in language and imagery that... No, they are both exorcism stories.
Uh-huh. But they're written two different places.
So the episode of the demoniac, the second one, is very long. In fact, it's the longest account of any that's found in Mark, and it's the longest version of this exorcism story in the synoptics. Matthew and Luke also include this story, but they're shorter. And so, Mark is known for his terseness in relating and describing things. Very direct, very short, very to the point. But for some reason, Mark chooses to make this exorcism story in chapter 5 a very long, detailed, includes a lot of details.
So why does he spend so many words on that?
And here we get to the point that we keep making. We need to set aside our modernist scientific reasoning. In the world of Jesus and Mark, storms are caused by supernatural forces, and demons are very real. We need to resist the temptation to reason our way out of what to us may be unfamiliar or uncomfortable readings of this text. Now, we don't like to think about demon possession. Now, I'm going to get to a little bit to the idea of what demon possession may actually have been, but that's... But the fact that demons were and spirits are active and very involved in the daily lives of people it was just common knowledge. It was just the way it was. Mm-hmm. So we need to step into the ancient Roman and Jewish worlds and seek to place ourselves among the original audience and make an effort to not just hear what was said, but feel what they felt. So the last part of chapter 4 is the calming of the storm. And I've titled this Redemption of Nature. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" This narrative picks up where the teaching episode that came just before leaves off. And so we've already noted that the way Mark arranged the previous section, he took bits and pieces of stories and events and sayings of Jesus and put it together into a single story. Mm-hmm. So this, it's in some ways, it's historical fiction. It didn't happen exactly this way.
It doesn't need to have happened exactly the way he told it for his tone to be faithful.
Yeah, and so in the previous episode, the setting was that Jesus was teaching from a boat a little ways away from shore, and the people, the crowds, were sitting on the shore. And apparently, now that we, in this scene, we see that, you know, there may have been other boats, too, around Jesus' boat, listening to Jesus' teaching. So it's just convenient for Mark in his arrangement of material to... And it probably did happen at some point that Jesus was teaching from sea to shore and decided to cross over. And so this new story of crossing the lake picks up. They're not alone as they leave. The other boats follow Jesus. Now, the sea is really part of the original creation story. It's part of the flood story as well. Sea, in ancient thought, represents chaos. Now, it's frequently the domain of evil and of demons. The sea is the abyss. It's where the dead go. So in the original creation story, God brings order out of chaos. Dry land is brought out of the sea. And then in the flood story, chaos, the flood story is about chaos returning to, chaos enveloping what was an orderly place. Part of the destruction is chaos coming to overcome order. In the recreation after the flood, as the waters recede, as chaos recedes, order returns. Now, in this present story in Mark, the waters of chaos and evil, they threaten to destroy God's family, of Jesus and the disciples. Jesus is asleep in the stern. It portrays the humanity of Jesus. And Jesus is so tired that not even a violent storm wakes him. And the other point may be that Jesus has no fear. Nothing can frighten him so that even a violent storm can't cause him to wake. At least from fear. He's able to sleep through even the most chaotic of situations. Now what happens here is that the disciples then wake Jesus. And their tone is that of a rebuke. Now they question Jesus. Why in the world are you able to sleep? Don't you know that we are perishing?
You should be at least fearful for us.
If not for himself.
In some ways, they're trying to control Jesus' actions. And they want to tell him what to do. They're telling Jesus that you shouldn't be asleep at this time. You should be caring for us. So first there's an accusation, don't you care? And second, it's a statement, we are perishing. Are either of those statements true?
Don't you care? Well, the accusation that he doesn't care is not true. And we are perishing, well, maybe was true without outside interference.
So, that's Mark's audience is feeling chaotic pressure from the empire. And so these would be maybe the same questions that they are asking. Don't you care? Don't you see that we are perishing? So Jesus rises and he is standing. The language here is one that who is in this violent storm is now standing as one who commands. There's military imagery now here. And he rebukes the wind. You don't just rebuke natural forces. It makes no sense. You rebuke someone who is intentionally, you know, a person or a being who is able to understand. And that's the imagery that Mark is portraying here. And
he's treating the wind as a person or
the demon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
It's a picture. This is very definitely a picture of exorcism.
Yeah. The wind has been personified as...
The wind and the sea has been possessed. Uh-huh. And so Jesus rebukes the evil spirits and demons that are present in the wind and the storm. Because these... So the disciples are familiar with storms. And yet even they, at least some of the disciples, they made their living fishing. And yet even they are afraid and they feel like they are going to perish. So the picture that we are getting here is that this is not just a storm. That this is a deliberate attempt by the evil forces, the evil spirits, to destroy Jesus and his disciples. They're trying to take advantage of their position, you know, their helpless position, to destroy them here and now. Satan failed to cause Jesus to rely upon himself at the beginning of his ministry. And now Jesus is growing in power. What better time to destroy this threat to the domain of Satan than in this helpless state? Jesus rebukes. The storm vanishes and it's replaced by not just calm, but a great calm. In both Hebrew and Greek mythologies, only God or gods possess the kind of power that can command nature. And usually only the chief gods command the kind of power that can totally silence all other powers. Jesus had rebuked the wind. Now Jesus rebukes his disciples. Why were you afraid?
Isn't it obvious?
The problem is fear. Fear is really at the root of all human problems. Fear leads to self-seeking in an attempt to control others. Fear is the opposite of faith. Now, Jesus asks, don't you have faith? Faith is not some mere intellectual assent to a set of knowledge or even acceptance that God can act, but actually placing one's trust in God and living a life based on that trust without fear. And perhaps the reason for Jesus' rebuke is that the disciples have been given plenty of examples already as to Jesus' power over disease and demons. And from there, they should have extrapolated the prior evidence to the storm. And Mark uses these stories now to illustrate the parables that were told in chapter 4. Like the seed that fell on rocky and weedy soil, the faith of the disciples were not yet sufficient to weather the storms. And now the disciples' responses, they were filled with great fear. Now, it could be read that they had great awe and respect for Jesus now, coming to understand something about his true identity.
Yeah.
Or it could be read that they were truly even more frightened than what the storm had caused, because they have begun to realize Jesus' true identity. Yeah. Or it could be both. This story would have been a great comfort to Mark's original audience. Now, Jesus is God, and he has all the requisite authority to command even nature.
But to them, it wasn't nature. To them, it was demons. It really was demons.
It really was. Yeah, nature was the domain.
It was
all the different aspects of nature had different spirits. The Jews didn't believe in no other deities, so they would assign it to angels or demons. So the conclusion is, no, Jesus is greater than any earthly power and anything that may be invoked in the name of any other being. Therefore, Caesar, who was viewed as a son of the gods, would have no real power over Christians. May be able to persecute, may be able to kill, but they would have no genuine power. What this story raises, though, is the problem of God's apparent silence and absence, especially amidst our trials.
And the people Mark is writing to might be struggling with that.
Right. And Mark doesn't answer that. He leaves it as a question. Probably because his point is it's supposed to be a mystery. We're not supposed to have this is why God answers sometimes and God seems to be...
Maybe he didn't know the answer.
He probably didn't. The answer is a mystery, is I think maybe Mark's point. But
faith... And that's still a very current struggle. That's a common reason for people to not believe in God. Because if there is a God, why doesn't he fill in the blank?
And you know, part of Mark's point, I think, in recording these examples from Jesus' life in his gospel account is that you know, there were eyewitnesses who personally experienced these things, and that should be enough for your faith. This has also been compared to the story of Jonah.
What?
This story of the storm.
The sea. Yeah. What?
Well, Jonah is called to go somewhere, to go to Nineveh to prophesy. Jesus asks the disciples to take him across the sea. A violent storm comes up. And there seems to be no hope.
Right. Like Jonah's proclamation.
In Jonah's story, when Jonah is thrown overboard,
right,
a great calm returns.
Oh, interesting. Jonas.
Now, there are some obvious differences between these stories. For example, the human response to the divine command. Jonah decided, no way, I know I'm going to go somewhere else.
Well, we have to restudy out what did those people think of Jonah.
It was mythology.
And was Jonah a good figure or a bad figure or something in between?
I don't know.
Okay. Probably in between.
He got really mad when God didn't destroy Nineveh.
Well, is Jonah a story of lack of faith?
Yeah.
Probably.
What caused the storm? I think this is one of the key questions, key differences.
There was a high and a low, and they were coming around in the...
But I don't think that's what is
in
assumed.
In Jonah's story, the implication is that the God of the Hebrews caused the storm.
The storm is a punishment.
In this story, what caused the storm?
Yeah.
The demon.
The demons. Where is God in each of the stories?
In the Jonah story, God is behind the storm.
God is the one up above, sending down the storm. Where is God?
And trying to push Jonah back to where he's supposed to be.
Where is God in Mark's story?
My question is...
Sleeping in the boat.
Does God use bad things to make you good? So, God uses a storm to make Jonah...
In
Mark's story, God is among the disciples. What was the human response to the storm?
Fear
in both cases. What stopped the storm? In Jonah's story, it was appeasement.
Appeasement to God. And
in Mark's story, what stopped the storm?
God said so.
God stopped the storm.
I can see the parallels now between the two.
So, let's take these two stories, Jonah and the coming of the storm. What is the image of God portrayed by each?
In Jonah, God is the angry authoritarian controlling figure, very much controlling. He controls the situation.
Or does God make good things come up bad? The only reason God is God, because he can always make good come up bad.
Well...
Doesn't mean he caused the bad.
Right. Yes.
But in Jonah's story, the reader is supposed to read it as God causing the storm.
Well, then we go back to the Pharaoh and hardening of the wax.
Heart?
Well, whether or not we agree with the conclusions of Jonah's story, I do think that in that setting, God is seen as creating the storm.
In post-exilic Jewish thought, it was God who caused the exile. It was so. Therefore, God is punishing. God punishes people for not being faithful. It's in that environment that Jesus comes. It's in that same environment that Mark is now retelling, possibly, the story of Jonah.
Well, and it's in a setting where people still look at Jonah as a reliable picture of God. And he's saying, no, God's in the boat. Mark is saying... God's not.
What saved you from the storm was the boat. What saved Jonah was the whale. Maybe God's the whale, not the storm.
Maybe. Or maybe it, maybe if Mark were to retell the story of Jonah, he would make God the whale. I think the Jewish people saw the story of Jonah, and they saw God as being the storm, punishing, rebuking, controlling. And Mark is saying, not what God actually is about. God is about, let's put God in the boat.
Well, why was Jonah in the water?
He got thrown in. Because that...
Why did he get thrown in?
Because he believed that was the only way to calm the storm.
Yeah,
sacrifice to the gods.
He advised the people on the ship to throw him in
but
to calm the storm.
He got, the reason he is even on the boat is because he was running away.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was showing lack of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Were the disciples... Why were the disciples in a boat? Were they escaping something?
No.
No.
Jesus commanded the disciples to take him across
the parallels are not across the board. The parallels, there are some parallels.
Well, what I've been...
The disciples' lack of faith manifested after the storm started.
It wasn't really a lack of faith. He didn't want the Ninevites saved.
Right.
He believed that God would save the Ninevites if he... Well, if he wasn't...
And he didn't want to look foolish.
It was ethnic hatred.
He believed that if he went to the Ninevites and said and gave the message from God that they might repent and God might save them, and he didn't want God doing that because he hated the Ninevites.
So we're not going to go down and proselyze the ISIS.
So, going on here, how might this story reinterpret and reapply the creation account?
How might this story be changing the creation account?
Yeah.
Reinterpreting the creation, how might creation change?
You know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, the Spirit hovered above the waters, and then in the next... In the 6 days, this order is brought out of chaos. How might Mark's telling of the coming of the storm represent a type of a new creation?
Well, if you put God in the creation rather than above and controlling it,
well, what is back of my mind from the beginning of the discussion today is we've got to put our scientific reasoning away. What is our fear? The two basic fears of mankind today is security of your nation or your culture, your civilization from outward influences of war. And the other one is, well, I guess there's three, financial security and health security.
Mm-hmm.
Are we putting our financial security the same place that they're putting their fear of the storms? Maybe we shouldn't be worried about the storms. Maybe we shouldn't be... We should do diligence, but we shouldn't be worried about our financial security.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to... When we walk out of church, we pick up our scientific knowledge that my financial security is on my shoulders and nobody else's.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, financial security can be taken away from you in a moment, so can health security
mm-hmm.
be
mm-hmm.
taken away in a moment,
mm-hmm.
with no hope of ever recovering.
Mm-hmm.
or I should say beyond hope of ever recovering.
Yeah, but we want to make sure that when we come out the other end, we can say it was of no fault of my own. I mean,
well,
bankruptcy...
Well, you're not diligent. It's just...
Well, that's where we live, and maybe we live on that fear too much. I agree we need to do diligence, but I'm trying to... These people lived thinking that the environment, the weather, the storms, what do we think of financial security? Do we control it or don't we?
Well, you definitely don't. Not really.
You can influence it by where you put it.
Uh-huh.
But what you're putting it in has more control over it than you do.
So what this first story is telling is, you know, it's also a retelling of the original creation account where God subdues the natural forces and brings it under his control so that the people that he creates, the family that he creates, are able to survive, not just survive, but thrive. In Mark's story, showing that Jesus does indeed have control over the natural forces, so that the new family that he is creating will be able to survive and thrive. Next, chapter 5, verses 1 through 20, is the story of the demoniac, and it's about the redemption of humankind. So the first one was redemption of creation. This is redemption of humankind. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. And for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he, Jesus, was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding on there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. This is the first mark and record of Jesus in Gentile lands. We know it's a Gentile land because of the pigs, for one.
True.
And because towards the end, Jesus tells the man to specifically go and tell others about him. Whereas in Jewish lands, Jesus was very consistent in telling people to keep silent. But it's not just a Gentile land, but a place of tombs where he lands. It's the place of the dead. Jesus enters what is known to be unclean. So what this story is showing is that not only that Jesus so far has only battled, really, the battle has come to him. Now Jesus is taking the battle against evil into enemy territory, into its own domain. So the invasion of the kingdom of God is progressing. Now, he's not just taking back what rightfully has always belonged to him, the Jews, but he is now invading that which would have been seen as outside the traditional boundaries of the Hebrew God, the Jewish God. The narrative is broken by a very vivid and lengthy description of the man with unclean spirits. Mark makes it a point to make sure that we know that no human power is able to control or restrain this man. He has been driven away from all human society and all human connections. In a way, he is no longer a man. He inflicts self-harm. The point, he's trying to destroy himself. He no longer behaves in a human manner. He's the very opposite of the original Adam. The creation account, the second creation account in Genesis 2 is really about the creation of man and bringing man into relationship with others. And what Mark is showing here is that the very opposite of that. This man has broken away, forced away from all human relationships. Notice that nowhere in this account any sort of cause or blame is placed. We don't know why this man became the way he is. Mm-hmm. He just is. This man can't even speak for himself. The spirits attempt to gain control over Jesus. So the spirits, the demons speak. And in their statement, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? This is not an acknowledgement of Jesus' divinity. It is an attempt to control Jesus. By using
a true name?
By using the true name, the full title of Jesus, they are trying to control, to prevent Jesus from controlling them.
In mythology, you hear stories about
stating a person's true name gives you control over.
Right, yeah. So was that part of the beliefs of the time?
Yeah.
And in a lot of mythologies, people hide their true names in order to prevent.
There were exorcists and such among the Jews, among the people of the time, and they had elaborate rituals.
Uh-huh. And stating the true name is part of that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And what is very different about the way Jesus performs exorcisms is, he doesn't. This is one of the few times that where he even asks for a name. But there's no ritual. There's nothing. He just commands. And these spirits, ironically, appeal to the only power stronger than Jesus in order to try to control him. I adjure you by God, by the only power greater than Jesus. But it doesn't work. So the invasion of the kingdom of God, this story shows, reaches even into Gentile lands, even into the realm of the unclean and the realm of the dead. And in the next two miracle stories that come, we're going to see more of that, where in the next one, the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years will be healed. And in the last miracle story, a girl of 12 years old who had died is raised back to life. So this invasion of the kingdom of God goes deeper and deeper. And Mark is showing that there is no power that can hold Jesus or the kingdom back, illustrating the parables that came in chapter 4, that the success of the kingdom is assured no matter what it may appear to us at the moment. It may even appear that the kingdom is retreating, yet the kingdom is still advancing.
Or even dead.
Or even dead, yeah. However, we notice that Jesus does not appear to have absolute power and authority over the demons. They ask for permission. The demons ask for permission to enter the pigs. And Jesus allows them to do so. Now we have questions or problems possibly with that idea. Why would Jesus allow 2,000 pigs to die? That's not Mark's concern, for one.
Can you imagine?
He is writing from a Judeo-Christian perspective in which pigs were still considered unclean. So destruction of pigs would not have been that much of a concern, for one.
For certain people.
For the
target audience.
But maybe there's something else that's going on.
Unclean spirits going into unclean animals.
Yeah, so you could explain it that way, but then maybe there's something else happening here. Maybe the audience needed to see that Jesus did indeed destroy the demons. Mm-hmm. Instead of demons disappearing,
they're out there going out to destroy more people.
I've always seen that in that story. Where are the demons now?
Well, that's what I might say. Okay, so what, the pigs died but the demons didn't, where'd they go?
Well, the demons simply cannot disappear into thin air. The story can't work that way.
But with the sea symbolizing death and the place of demons.
The demons have to finish their work of destruction. They weren't able to do it in this man. They came close, but they weren't able to. And so Jesus permits their work to occur in the pigs nearby. And in their destruction of the herd of the pigs into the sea, the destruction and return of the demons to their place of origin, the sea, is symbolized.
The pigs throw themselves into the sea off the cliff.
So the demons, that wasn't their intent. Their intent was to live on and be demons, but they went into the sea and got absorbed into chaos and they're gone.
They're gone. Now,
so the intention is when they go into the pigs and are thrown into the sea, the intention is to understand that
what the audience is supposed to understand is that the demons are now destroyed and dead. The hired hands go and tell the herd owners what has happened, and they return with the rest of the city and witness the infamous formerly possessed man now clothed in his right mind. The man's humanity has been restored. He is a new creation.
Uh-huh.
This is a retelling of Genesis 2. They put so the crowd now puts the two together, and they extrapolate what has happened. They understand, and they become afraid, very much like the disciples after the calming of the storm. The citizens are fearful of the consequences and demands of having Jesus continue his invasion of the kingdom of the world. And so they ask him to leave. What's important is Jesus doesn't insist on staying. He says, you know, if I'm not wanted, I'll leave. He leaves when he's asked. The man asks to go with Jesus. It's certainly understandable. The citizens didn't want Jesus around, so well, what might happen if he stays around? Yet he too doesn't insist on going with Jesus when Jesus specifically tells him, I want you to stay. Jesus does not permit the man to accompany, but sends him out really as the first apostle to the Gentiles. It's interesting that there's no discipleship course or training. There's no set of fundamental beliefs or a creed to follow. The only instructions given to this apostle is to tell everyone about what has happened, about God's mercy that was shown to him. And really, this is the core of evangelism. Evangelism is not telling you what you telling people about what you believe, but what... but about what God has done, about the mercy God has shown to you. And as was noted earlier, there's no restriction placed on this man, like with the Jews. The Gentiles did not have any messianic expectations that would place Jesus in conflict with Rome.
That makes sense.
And
the Gentiles saying God did good for me, and having a name of a person who went with it wasn't consistent.
And it appears that this man's testimony is accepted around the region. So he goes all around Decapolis. There were 10 cities in the region, and this man apparently went around and told everyone about what Jesus did and about the mercy God has shown him.
And probably one look at him and all his scars, they knew exactly who he was.
Probably.
The witch.
And, you know, the similarities with this story and Jonah's account in Nineveh, I think, are present in this part of this story as well. So in Nineveh, Jonah's mission was to the Gentiles. He didn't go there. Or he didn't want to go there. When he did go there, kind of forced to go there, he had success for which he was unhappy. Jesus, he goes to Gentile lands, and then he commissions this Gentile to further go. And he has success. So the gospel is not just for the Jews, it's for the Gentiles, it's for the whole world. And maybe in Mark's putting these two together with some of the similarities we've seen with the story of Jonah, with the similarities we've seen with the accounts of creation, he is retelling both of those stories in the context of Jesus. Not just in the context of Jesus, but Jesus as the God of the Hebrews, of the Old Testament. Maybe he's saying that this is how we are supposed to reinterpret those old stories. Now, we have some problems with this story, again, demon possession. What is interesting is that it's not, technically, the words do not mean demon possession. It means demon oppression, which is a very different thing. demon possession was not known in ancient times. Oppression was known, but actual possession was not known. So when we in English read demon possession, we need to read it as not demon present within a person, but being harassed and being oppressed by demons. And we discussed Jesus permitting the destruction of pigs. Now, life and wealth, we have some issues with that, but it's not Mark's point to discuss it. And this idea that possibly Jesus does not have absolute control over evil yet, which is an important point, because why do bad things happen today? Well, God is not
in total control.
Now,
demon, we are oppressed by ill health, but we're not possessed by ill health.
True. High blood pressure isn't considered possession.
Possessive.
People don't get possessed by cancer. They may well be harassed and oppressed by it.
We are financially oppressed, but not
possessed.
So he doesn't have absolute control over the particulars, but he does have control over the outcome.
Yeah, it's part of Mark's illustrating through Jesus' action what his teaching was. You know, in the parables, the three parables of the seeds, you know, sometimes the outcome in the middle stage may appear uncertain, but in the end, success is always guaranteed. The kingdom may not grow like we expect it to. And even as members of the kingdom may not provide in the way that we might want it to at this present time, but in the end, the kingdom will be successful.
Well, I think I made some very poor financial decisions with these cars.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, I say that if I hadn't made that poor decision, theoretically, I would be wealthy today. But I'm starting to wonder if that's not true. I don't dismiss that I made a poor decision, but my condition today probably has no reflection of that decision, is because
he would have spent it on something else.
God is in control regardless of our actions, and so if I am prudent in my decisions and what I do or not do, when I end up where I end up, rather than looking at myself as the cause of where I am, I need to look at God as the cause of where I am.
So if you are destitute and end up homeless, it's God's fault?
Maybe
or God wanted you to be that way?
You just flipped it upside down, didn't you?
Or
I look at it as what happens.
We need to bring in some of Paul's letters and exhortations. It's important to be prudent and diligent.
Right.
But at the same time, don't be so worried about the results.
Mm-hmm. And don't judge people who haven't.
In fact, don't be worried about the results.
Uh-huh. And not only not to be worried about the results, maybe what you think is the result you're not responsible for at all.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you think, okay, let's say I made a lot of good decisions, therefore I'm wealthy, therefore I'm responsible, my decisions, therefore I'm responsible for where my good position.
And the other guy isn't wealthy, therefore he must have made a lot of bad decisions.
Exactly. But
and he must be a bad person.
But what we need to do is make prudent decisions. But where we physically are, or financially are, in reality has no...
Yeah, your circumstances don't...
Just are.
And I'm kind of wondered about that, is if I had not bought those cars, financially, I probably would be exactly where I am today, regardless.
Don't know.
When you make a good decision, that decision has a chance of affecting your future. It doesn't mean it will.
The same with poor decisions?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Poor decisions have a chance of negatively influencing your future. Doesn't mean it will.
But maybe the conclusion is that I'm responsible for my future. And maybe I really am not responsible for my future.
Chance is partly responsible. God, of course, is largely responsible.
Partly responsible, and you are partly responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And
does Mark agree with that?
As a Christian, your responsibility is to live out what God has called you to do, whatever that may be. To grow, to invest in the kingdom of God. And that means scattering seeds, according to Mark. And some of the seeds will end up in places where they don't fruit. But that's fine.
But I'm trying, I think I am working on this. I need to make prudent decisions every day. But I'm disassociating my accountability for the outcomes. But the outcomes
in the Christian life, how well off you are, perhaps because of your own actions, isn't what's important.
Yeah.
What's more important is how you affect other people.
Specific note, it has personal application, has church family applications, where churches and denominations are so concerned with the actual results at times. And the message that Mark is giving to his church is, don't be so concerned. Your responsibility is to sow seeds, and God will do the rest. You may be called to sow seeds in a place where, in fact, you may not see any growth whatsoever.
Wait, Baker. Actually,
I don't know if we're sowing seeds enough. I'm sure I have a lot of fun.
I think they sow seeds for us.
That's exactly right.
You know, it's not.
We can learn from each other. It doesn't have to be
a one.
Yeah, but the kingdom. The power. See, the power is in the seed itself. It's not in you. The power is in power to grow and fruit is in the seed. The kingdom will grow, and it may grow and fruit in a way that you never expected or recognized.
We don't recognize what the kingdom really is. But we're supposed to not worry about the clothes on our back. The flowers, don't worry about.
I mean, think about it. Think about the Jesus and disciples as they leave the former demoniac. I mean, here could have been someone that Jesus could have put up as a trophy.
Uh-huh. Yeah. in evangelistic meetings, stand him up and say, "This man."
What they, from all appearances, they had a totally failed effort. It was one man, and the community has basically rejected what had happened.
Yeah.
Yet, later, when they come back to the region, they accept.
What is it that they accepted?
God's mercy.
God's influence in their lives because of the influence they've seen in someone else.
The ability of God to restore and heal even this man, which was basically no longer a man.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, all the rest of them.
Even though the people were devastated financially and there was an amazement that had an flood into their lives of
even though it started out with just plain fear,
there was an amazement.
See, I think people's lives are really driven by fear. When you said that at the beginning.
Yeah.
And if you can cast out that fear, then they can start being a human being, because fear, but how does it do that?
That's the mystery of the seed, I think, that Mark's parables told. We don't know how it happens. But
human beings who are driven by fear cannot live.
Yep. And I think Mark's point is that we can't drive out fear by trying to drive out fear.